This is Voices of Lancashire, a podcast about migrants who live in Lancashire and made their home here. I am your host, Lara Momesso. I live in Lancashire and I am an Italian migrant myself. Voices of Lancashire is born out of my personal experience, which I am sure is shared by many other immigrants. How many times have people asked us the question, "Where are you from?" And how many times have the same people made assumptions about who we are and what we do here, precisely because of our nationality? Assumptions that do not necessarily correspond to our life stories. Out of this experience, I decided to create Voices of Lancashire, a space where migrants who live in Lancashire talk about their life stories, why and how they moved to Lancashire, their impressions of this part of the world, their ambitions and their everyday life experiences in a place that has become their permanent or temporary home. For this first series, Voices of Lancashire will consist of 12 episodes published fortnightly, each with an immigrant living in one of Lancashire County districts. If you are an immigrant interested to know more about the experiences of other fellow immigrants, or a local interested to know more about the life experiences of your new neighbors, this podcast is definitely for you. Follow me. Hi, everyone. Today's episode is with Irene, an Egyptian migrant from Cairo who arrived in Preston in 2016, and she stayed there until 2023. So you can see that Irene's situation is very similar to Graciela one, the Argentinian woman I interviewed a few episodes ago. She has also left the UK and she's now living in another place. Irene is in Albania with her family in a small town in the outskirts of Tirana. Thank you so much for being with us, Irene, today.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks. So, how I met Irene? I met Irene a few years ago in the place where I work, at UCLan. At that time, she was doing a PhD and working as a student coach at the university. And Irene is the person who introduced me to the world of coaching. Her profession is a life and business coach. So I would like to start by talking about your profession, Irene. Can you share with the audience what does your job consist of and what are the principles that lead your coaching work?
Absolutely. What a wonderful question. So my profession as an executive and business coach has many, let's say, dimensions to it. So coaching, in essence, is about being a partner with the person on the journey that they're taking, whether it is related to a business goal that they have or a personal goal that they have. And so in the work of coaching, I personally do four different like types. One is around that executive life coaching. So someone who's at an executive corporate level, and the coaching encompasses a whole person development. So that's why I call it executive life. It has a bit of both. The second kind is geared more towards developing the culture within organization. I call it leadership culture coaching. So I come in to help a leadership team or a group of leaders where the coaching is impacting how they are shaping the culture of the organization. So that has another kind of aspect to it. The third kind is called team coaching. And the kind of team coaching we do at the company is called it more around systemic. So we look at what is happening in the whole system, which means the team and the team's influence with the stakeholders and so forth. So the coaching we do opens the eyes of the team as to how their behaviors and their mindsets influence others. And the very last kind of coaching is with coaches. So I just put it all together. So I do coach education, coach mentoring, coaching supervision. And that's the kind of work that deepens the learning of the coach of who they are.
And what are the principles that lead your coaching work?
So I do coaching that is called depth coaching. And there are around seven principles that I use in this kind of work. The first of all is that we look at coaching the person, not the problem or the solution. I believe in the people that I work with, that the person is whole, resourceful, and creative. So we work with coaching the person. The second principle, that we are responsible to the coachee, not for, and for the process. So we believe the coachee is responsible for their growth. The third principle is we build a relational space. So our coaching is around the relationship in essence. Everything is around relationship, relationship with oneself, relationship with the other, relationships of all kinds. So we look at that space. The fourth principle we hold is that we hold a space for the emergent. And it's something we also educate our clients. So we may not know everything, and the coachee may not know actually the essence of their goal, but we discover together. So it's allowing for whatever emerges is extremely important. Principle five is we enable flow and awareness within the coachee's consciousness. So really, depth coaching takes our coachee and our clients to a higher level of conscious awareness. How much are they becoming aware of their own awareness? That's the level of consciousness that they arrive at. Principle six is around enabling flow within our own consciousness. So our own consciousness as coaches is actually flowing within this relationship. So we don't separate our growth from that of our client. Every relationship allows us to grow too. And that's the key principle with anybody that we work with or partner with as coaches in the group work that we do. And the principle seven, last but not least, that we are here to do the work. It's a big one, but that means we, as in coaches and our coachees. And doing the work is an internal process before it is externally felt in terms of outcomes that people come for. And sometimes the coachees themselves may not really know what they're getting into because it emerges. It's not that it's a secret. And we talk about it in our very first sessions, that this will take its shape on the journey. And as we go on the journey, there are pauses to check in that we're, you know, aligned, that this is what they signed up for, or it may be usually they're more happily surprised that this is what they're getting also, because they're getting everything else at the same time. But it does have what we call, we are doing our work as we are addressing the goals that they bring into the space.
Thank you so much for this explanation. And I know that you work in a very international environment. I know that many of your customers are in the Middle East. So I was wondering, within your work, how much of your work is about actually also intercultural communication? Because you are talking about relationships, right? A lot. If this is an international environment with people from different backgrounds, I expect, maybe I'm wrong, just tell me. Yeah, how much is it about explaining how to deal with people who have a different culture, which at the end of the day is the condition of migrants wherever they go, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It has everything, actually. Given that I have maybe lived and grown or lived and worked in around four or five continents, and my work has been fully international, I find the culture of the individual takes center stage, usually during the journey, because culture is a packed word, and I look at culture in many dimensions. It's not necessarily nationality, but nationality, yes, is one aspect. But I dig deeper with my clients, coachees, to look at culture from societal expectations on you, parental expectations that you've endorsed or maybe not. Now you're discovering that you are endorsing them or changing them. Beliefs that could be going back to religion, or traditions that go back to generations before you. And so all of that colors the space in coaching, because in essence, we are working on creating something new on that journey, which requires a change often in beliefs, a change in habits, patterns, mm-hmm. values, and all of it comes back to culture. And I look at culture as a mosaic. I often provide that metaphor so that people can see the color, the different beauty that comes with differences or different kinds of parts of us. But oftentimes on the consciousness journey, as we become more aware of who we are, we start to choose with intent what serves us moving forward that perhaps served us in the past, but we're now choosing to let go of, add more of, shift. And so you kind of create your own individual culture, which has a part of your current culture that you've taken on board, you stay with, and then you create your own and you live that through your work. So it has a lot to do with that because it brings up resistance. It brings up tension.
That's precisely what I was going to ask you. What, in your experience, if you see any pattern, what is the main challenge to push people towards this self-awareness about their culture? So where does resistance come from in a general pattern? I'm sure that each single person has a different life experience or approach, but is there something that is more common?
Yeah, what comes to me, usually the challenge is fear. Fear around losing our identity, the one we know or we think we are. And that's a big one because that has many shapes. We don't end it because we've chosen intentionally to move somewhere else or do something different. But it's how do we work with it? How do we allow it to be there and work with it versus pushing it, hiding it, denying it, all of that? A part of it also could be shame. We're ashamed that we are moving away from very big beliefs or values our parents hold or something like that. Or we have shame put on us because we are deciding to take a different path. So it's not our shame. If we're not conscious and mindful, we absorb it because people with good intent want you to stay loyal to certain things that they find valuable, which have value, but it may not be your path for your future self, like the work you've come to do in the world. So fear and shame, guilt. Shame is a powerful one, though, because it touches identity. You have to really be mindful that you are much more than beliefs, habits, and patterns. But these are the two that usually when we come to resistance, fear, and fear can be fear of loss, fear of anger from people, or just fear of the unknown. You're on a path that's very different. So just not knowing brings fear. Yeah, death is a big one, but it's not like you're killing your old. It's just renewing. You've got to let go. Let that grief comes in. Maybe that's what I was trying to get to. Grief is a big one because change brings grief with fear. It's not one or the other. It could bring them all three. But knowing what we're dealing with, it's really an emotion. And that brings the emotional intelligence part of the work with the cultural intelligence part of the work. Knowing what are these emotions is helpful to see how do we work with them and allow them to be there and then still move forward with what we are trying to create in the life that we have that's worth creating, worth for you to take this journey.
Thank you so much. I think this, what you just said, resonates with experience of many people who move away from the family, the country, the place they come from. And it was like a mini coaching session or a hint of what it could be. Definitely, you gave a lot of food of thought to think about what we think we are and how we deal with our identity, the one we keep, the one that we built up during our life, and how we allow it to change or not to change, because that's precisely, I think, some of the important challenges that we face as migrants, maybe unconsciously most of the times, but is so much part of our life. Good, Irene. So we move to another question. I want to know a bit more about your personal life. Can you tell us where you've been before arriving in Preston and how your life on the move has shaped who you are and the way you approach not just your coaching work, but also your life?
So I'm Egyptian by connection to my parents. So they're both Egyptian, but I was born and raised in Saudi Arabia, Riyadh, for 15 years. So that's a big chunk of my life in the Saudi culture. However, at the same time of those 15 years, I went to an American international school. So I had this American international influence, let's say, for the 10 years of those 15, by the time I went into school and on and so forth. And so for 15 years, I had the Egyptian, the Saudi, and the American international kind of mix pot that I was in for 15 years. And obviously, having lived in Saudi Arabia, I had friends and neighbors who were from different Arabic countries and Western countries. But then afterwards, I went to the UK for boarding. I had a 3-year scholarship in a boarding school. And I lived 3 years by myself with other nationalities. So for year one, I was in a room with someone who was from Japan, another from the States, and a third from Britain. And I was the fourth. So we were four in the room. And then every year I had different nationalities and it was boarding. I lived alone for those 3 years. Then I went to my home country for university. So Egypt, Cairo is where I actually lived for the first time for 4 years. Worked there after for 4 years. So you can say a total of eight and two more here and there, really around 10 years in Egypt. And then the biggest chunk of my work life was in the UAE. So I lived there 10 years. And I consider it after Egypt being my first national home and Saudi being where I was another home, UAE was like almost my third big home, or fourth, because it's after the UK. Then I came to the UK when I came back, let's say, to the UK with my husband. So these are like the big blocks of where the different countries, the different nationalities that I lived and how it shaped. I think every culture I lived in, I took away something, whether I was consciously taking it away, subconsciously, but I took up pieces of values, beliefs, and habits from each one. And that's why I believe in our coaching, we each individually have a cultural mix that's very unique to us. And it's really important to notice what we've taken from each of these cultures and made our own versus what we want to keep in us for the next half of our life and what we want to bring in, because it could be something totally different. Because now we're a global world. You're on YouTube, we're watching this. It's open. We hear things from different countries. We travel a lot more. And so we've picked up things unconsciously from other cultures. And it's part of the work. And that's why I bring it in and I call it the mosaic, because you are making your own painting, your own artistic, creative life by putting all those pieces together, but intentionally when you're on the coaching journey.
I'm sure that there are many features for each of your homes or countries where that link to you connect to. But can you give us an example of what you brought from each of these cultures?
Good question. So let's start with Saudi, since that's where I started. I think it's the collectiveness. There's something about Saudi culture. I think it is common in all the Arab cultures. There's a collective spirit, like we do things together. It's part of how we make decisions. There's a big focus on the collective coming to an agreement before a person says, this is it, kind of thing. And I lived with that, I think, for the first 15 years. It is similar to Egypt, but that's a big criteria in how we even work and live in Saudi Arabia. It was a very families get together and they decide together. Things may take some time till we decide, but things get decided in a way where everybody's on board. And I think that's also a big value in the culture of Saudi Arabia. Things are done with a collective spirit. What about Egypt? I'm not sure how, I mean, it does have the collective space. I think in Egypt, there's the humor that I try to bring in. Not that I am great at it, but there's a light spirit, humor that Egyptians, I think, are known for. Life can be tough in Egypt. It is tough for a lot of us and for a lot of people around the world. But I think the society in Egypt has some genius in making things a bit humorous while we're in the midst of our crisis kind of thing. So I think that is something I took away, and bringing that bit of lightness or humor, or we even make fun of ourselves sometimes, because not to take life too seriously, which I can do a lot as well. But that, I think, maybe I can attribute to Egypt. The UK, no, I went to the UK. I lived in the UK on two different occasions, when I was a student and when I was married and a parent. I think the UK allows me to shine with my individuality. Yeah, it pushes me there, allows me to go there, accepts my individuality, regardless of how geeky I may be or unique in my way. It'll take me as I am. And wherever I want to take it, it will allow me to take it. So that individuality really shines for me there. The UAE is where I lived a big chunk of my work life. I think the UAE built, there's a sense of high standards, quality, top of the game in every field. So that's like a blanket statement. Like if you're going into HR, if you're going into digital, if you're going into science, it really touches me. And I think it allowed me to, maybe it nurtured that in me. I mean, I love beauty. I love living it my all, giving it my all. And so that having those high standard of living, high standard of work ethic, high standard of, you know, trends in work, trying to be at the top of your game all the time, I think that's really strong in the UAE culture. Also with that collectivist, I think, Arab common spirit. Yeah, that made me reflect quite deeply. I didn't know I had those things.
But it was a lovely answer, because I think you allowed us to see, to open a window in each culture. Obviously, it's just a feature. Each culture is much more complex, but I think you provided a picture of some features that are important to, at least I know quite well the UK, and definitely individuality is something that, as you said, that shines for me as well. And I come from a society in which individuality is not as appreciated. So yeah, something I learned it here. So I'm sure that also what you said about Egypt and the other places is also giving a hint of the broader cultural setting. Good. So, Irene, I want to know now, why did you decide to come to Preston? And also, once you arrived, what was your first impression of Preston? And did it change after?
So I decided to come to Preston for family reasons. So prior, I was married. I still am to the same person, but we got married in the UAE. And at that time, he was based in the UK, in Preston, but had long work projects in different countries, of which the UAE was one. And then it was Singapore, then it was others as the work required. But it was a decision that we made collectively. Where would we want to set up family? Whether it was he was going to leave Preston, or was it I going to leave the UAE, Dubai? And we chose Preston, and it was the right decision, because at that time, I had been in the UK living for some time. And prior, I mean, I had lived there before, and I knew I loved the idea even of just coming to the UK and starting life there. It was going to be logistically a bit difficult for my husband to leave his job where he was for quite some 20 years and do that. It was easier for me And maybe it had to do with my upbringing, having had traveled and relocated. And I think I had that readiness to start again somewhere else. So that's why we chose Preston. And my husband was there already. And that's where he lived the majority of his life in the UK. When I arrived, the location of where we lived allowed me to experience Preston. The busy center, we were near the center main street of Preston. We were near the main park that was there. And it allowed me to meet people who worked in the area when I went down in the center. It allowed me to take time with my son and enjoy the nature. And I think Preston has a really nice student/buzzy center in some places that I found enjoyable. I think then as COVID hit and things have started to change in those past years, everything kind of slowed down a bit. But I love the student experience, student flavor, because of the UCLan University that is there. It's large and it brings a really nice mix of lots of cultures you find in Preston, different nationalities you find walking on the street. And that was enjoyable.
Good. And then after a few years, you decided to leave Preston. So can you tell us how you decide to leave, why you decided to leave?
Yeah, the decision was mainly, again, family. COVID had a big hit on us not being able to travel as we wanted to when it kind of released. We couldn't still easily travel to Egypt or back to my husband. Originally, his family lineage comes from Albania. I found it hard for people to come to visit. My sister tried to come twice, but no visa. Even my parents, it took a bit of time. So I think that played a big role, that I was the one who had to travel and that I couldn't find people who come to visit me easily. And so when there was that time where we were home, mainly family was far, it made a big connection in our mind that once things come back to normal, we really wanted to be close to family a lot more often. And so we decided to relocate outside and come to Albania. Yeah.
And I know when I met you, you were working as a coach for students at UCLan. So I would like to ask you, what have you learned about British society, or even more than British society, is about British youth, because you were working with British students, right, through your coaching job?
So working with or coaching the youth from the University of Lancashire made me see that the youth are really looking for ways to create. They're inspired by creating something in society. They want to do something big. So all the sessions, all the coaching sessions that I had, they were students from masters in leadership and management. And in each of their sessions, they came to the university to change something about their future. And a lot of them were working students or going back to work. So they took some time off and they came to make a difference. And I'm finding that all the youth that I've been interacting with, they had something else next to education on their agenda. And that's very inspiring, that at a young age, they're already thinking, how are they going to make a difference? What is it that they want to create? And those who didn't have it all, because not everybody had clearly what they wanted to do, the question was in their mind and reflecting on how they bring value and where to spend time is something I feel like I wasn't there when I was at that age thinking about that just yet. That came later to me. So I thought that was really inspiring.
That's a very nice image. Especially if we think that very often we tend to portray youth as without ideas or without will to do things in contemporary times, which I think is something that comes across generations anyway, because when I was much younger, that was the argument against youth me. And I see that now is repeated against youth nowadays. So to see such an inspiring, vibrant image.
Yeah, I feel it's a bit unfair that the youth have this thing thrown at them as if they are entitled. I hear it too. They're entitled, they're not working hard enough, or and all that. And I think, well, obviously there are I'm sure, people who feel like that. But I think the youth who are doing something, and it's not that everybody needs to go to a university, but especially the ones who are, or the ones who are taking on education in a different way, through a business or through voluntary work or whatever it is that they put themselves in and through, that is growing them, developing who they are as a person. And I think the new generation is really thirsty for making a difference. They're not bothered too much by a certificate or a degree, or I mean, it could come handy if they're looking at global work, because that's how globally people ask for, where is your certificate? Or just to compare globally, people ask these questions, especially if they're looking for work in the Middle East, at least, or maybe other countries. They also, as a society, it's used as a benchmark to see where people are. But if you make it otherwise, and depending on your path of career, if you're a creative artist or if you're a musician or other types of careers that don't necessarily need a specific certificate, it's by the work that you do and you show you can do it, then the sky's the limit. I think we just, the youth look at things differently. And those who are not able to connect on how they look at things differently spurt out those assumptions that they're entitled and lazy and all that.
Yeah, I completely agree with what you say. So is there, your job seems very fascinating. It's talking to people, right? What do you like of your job?
Everything, really. The main thing why I do this work, I always kind of put it in a very small phrase, if I need to limit it, it's co-creating the next generation of conscious leadership. So every conversation that I have, if I am able to provide them space where their conscious awareness rises, I feel I've done my work. And I feel that becoming more consciously aware, raising consciousness, is the work the world needs. Because that is hard work. Internally, I'm asking my coaches, my clients, my partners, you can call them different things. They're really my partner. I'm their partner, to raise the bar on how we are becoming humans.
I know you're very passionate about your job. So I would like to ask you a question about Egypt. Before, you mentioned that actually you saw, or you lived in Egypt as an adult when you went there, a young adult, when you went there for your university. I wonder, what does Egypt mean to you after so many years far away? And it's just not just after so many years far away, it's also after a life far away from there. How do you refer to it as a home still?
That question has come up for me actually many times. And really what I feel Egypt resembles in me is history. I mean, I'm proud of the history of Egypt, going back from the pharaonics and all the achievements that they had, whether it's in science, art, math, and so forth. I mean, that gives me great pride. And although I'm not someone who studied that so much, but I'm always feeling a sense of pride when I hear about things being discovered still about the history of Egypt, going back centuries. But what connects it to me personally on an individual level today is really family, I must say. It's the space where I feel that I'm home when I see my parents, when I see my relatives, when I connect with people from childhood, because I did visit Egypt on vacations during the first like that couple of 20 years before I landed there for university. And so I always connect with it a sense of joy, like I'm going on vacation. So when I go back to Egypt, it's like I'm going on vacation. That's the sense I'm always carrying with me. And it's not necessarily that I go to the beach or see the pyramids or any of that, but I get the sense of lightness, love, people that I haven't seen for long, even walking down the street that I haven't walked down for so many years, and it looks different, or it's got more buildings or more trees or whatever, however it changed. It's just a nice feeling of joy and lightness. And I'm still feeling always on vacation. And I do feel like I'm still a foreigner when I go there, just because it's a place that I usually connect with vacations with. And it's sometimes odd for people to hear that I'm a foreigner in my home country. I just think it's natural. It's just how I feel. Like, I don't know too much about how to go, where to go. So I have a bit of that foreigner flavor, expat person, but it's still my home. And I love that feeling, being at home like a tourist sometimes.
Expat at home could be a new book.
Yes.
I'm curious about what is the perception of Egypt outside of Egypt, especially in the UK? Does it reflect the world you come from? Were there things you wanted or you felt like you wanted to challenge when people, when you said I'm from Egypt?
Having been in the UK for some time and seeing a lot of Egyptian documentaries around a lot of pharaonic history brings the perception that Egypt has a rich history. And usually when I meet people and I say I'm from Egypt, I think their mind goes to there. They talk about the fascination of things that they visited, because there's so much to visit, whether it's not just the pyramids, but Luxor and Aswan, that has a lot of the monuments and things that they're still discovering, tombs and all that. Or I meet some people and their mind goes to diving, because Egypt is known for some of its beautiful coral locations for diving and stuff. I'm not that kind of person who does diving, but I know that these places there. I've met some people where I say I'm from Egypt and they may not know that we also have a modern Egypt. What's that like? They may not connect with it easily. I've once met someone in the airport, but that's not about UK though, but it was someone in the airport and I said, I'm from Egypt. And he says, do you still ride camels there? I don't know if I rolled my eyes, but I was like, okay, yes, we've got camels if you want to go to the desert. But we've got a lot of modernization too, if you happen to just check the internet or come visit. But I think generally people may perceive Egypt as busy, crowded, but there's aliveness. The light doesn't go off. You know, people are out on the streets 24/7. And I mean it, 24/7. So if you're a night owl, you'll find all the restaurants, all the cafes, all the shopping places open. And if you're an early bird, you've got it still open whenever you get up. And you go. So it's, you have that and you have the serenity if you want to really go to the desert and meditate and or the beach. I think it's got it all. It depends on when you went to visit. People talk from that perception. Or just the TV, then it's more like the documentary history stuff.
So coming back to your life, I mean, it's not your life, your connection. You lived in Preston for about 6 years. You also lived before 3 years in the boarding school, right? So do you feel like you belong or you belonged to Lancashire or to the UK when you were living here?
I think to the extent, because it allowed me to show up as who I am. What is my individuality, as I said earlier, was I was able to own it and walk in it. I think where I sometimes did not know how to fit was the lifestyle, because I was born and raised, or the majority of my life was more in a lifestyle that was almost awake all the time, and it was warm. You could sit out in the evening and have a tea in a cafe. I think that's where I felt I couldn't find many people who would want to do that. And so coming as an adult to live there and me changing the preferences, like nobody drinks tea in a cafe in the evening, or you'll need to go a little bit search for it, or that was a bit maybe difficult. And so it's finding the group of people who I enjoyed doing things that are not traditional in Lancashire took a bit of challenge, took a bit of time. Shopping in the evening, like who would go shopping at 9 or 10 p.m.? Nobody.
There are no shops open.
No shops open, full stop. But it's so different in Egypt, UAE, Saudi. I mean, it's buzzing. So that was the part where I felt, you know, I can't, how do I continue the way I wanted to live? So I had to change a lot of my habits, patterns. Yeah, and that didn't come easily. That was the part, I think the lifestyle bit. But in being accepted, belonging from a values, beliefs, individuality, who I am as a person, that was fine. That was an easy thing.
Okay, and now I pass to the last question, which I usually ask to everyone. I wanted to ask you whether you think or plan to return to your homeland eventually, but considering your background, maybe the right question should be, is there a place that you consider your home, your first home, or your home where you would like to go back?
My home is where my family is. I don't tie home to geographical location. So now that I'm married and I have my younger son, my home is now Albania. I really do feel home. I do feel a sense of connection here. It's where I find the love. But I also have a part of me in Egypt because my parents are there. That's home. Although I was not born or raised there. A little bit in my life. The UK, I would find, is a home, but only if I come with family. Like if my husband and my son come together, yes, I would say that's my home for whatever period we decide that that's going to be. I'm one of those people where you say, this coming year, Albania is my home. The last 6 or 7 years, UK was my home. So it's really where I have that family tie. And it doesn't need to be a standard one place. I don't connect to home being a one place. It's hard for me. It's really hard being an expat all my life, pretty much born in a different country. Saudi Arabia was my home for the first 15 years, literally was my home. Parents, friends, everything. I didn't know anything other than that. That was home. And when I go back, there's a sense of missing the piece of me that of home. It's different now. It's a lot more open now. It was a lot different when I was there being growing up. Yeah. And there's a piece of home in me with all of them. It's very, very hard for me to say, where's your home? And I struggle with that. When people ask me, where are you from? I generally try to figure out, are they trying to ask about nationality so I can say Egyptian, British? Are they asking about where I lived most of my life, because maybe that's what they're trying to figure out. So I sense when the question comes, do I have a lot of time to explain, or is it just a quick one? So I pick one. And I roll with that. Yeah.
It's actually a very interesting answer, what you gave to this question, because this is the last interview of this first series. And interestingly, the very first question, it was with an Italian guy, Alessandro. And when I asked him the same question, he said, my home is where my family is. So currently his family is here in the UK, his children, his wife. So he feels like his home is here. But if the children decide to move, most probably would like to move with them. So I think it was a very nice way to start the conversation and also to close it. 12 interviews after, we go back to most probably again another kind of, I wouldn't say universal, but almost universal amongst those people who move a lot and have to eventually juggle between different countries, cultures, places, and also dislocated families. So I think that with this, we have reached the end of today's interview. Irene, thank you so much for being with us today, for sharing with us your life experience in Lancashire and beyond. This is also the last interview of this first series. It was a magical experience for myself, both the process of identifying the 12 interviewees and also talking to them. I hope with my whole heart that these episodes have left a mark in the life and mind of you, dear listeners. And I hope it doesn't end here and there will be other series in the near future. In the meanwhile, if you have any comments, suggestions, ideas of people who could be interviewed, contact me at voicesoflancashire@gmail.com or like my Facebook page, Voices of Lancashire. For now, thank you everyone and bye-bye.
Bye-bye.